Inside the Huddle with Sky Sports, Neil Reynolds and Jeff Rimebo.
Yes, hello and welcome to Inside the Huddle in association with NFL Shop Europe. We're sponsored by DraftKings.co.uk, your home of one day fantasy sports. I'm your host, Neil Reynolds, on the bus with Pro Football Hall of Famer Kurt Warner. This could actually be a tricky interview because Kurt will paint you a tale of betrayal and trust. But I think that, Kurt, I think because I beat you in a passing competition last night.
Well, I don't really consider that a passing competition. First of all, you used tiny little kid balls.
Rubber balls.
Right. And we threw it like 4 feet into a bucket. So it wasn't even really throwing the ball. But hey, okay.
For me, I
get a chance to redeem myself, right? Do I get a chance to redeem myself?
I think we should play
it
again.
I think
we should
do it again, too.
Yes.
I think we ought to. I need another shot at it.
Yes, I think we should. But yeah, that's sad that it's my my claim to fame. But great to have you on this tour. Great. Congratulations on the Hall of Fame. Let's start there. What did that mean the day before the Super Bowl to get that news? And how did you find out? How do you find out?
Well, actually, it's kind of a weird process. So what they do is they want to announce the Hall of Famers at our new award ceremony. It's called the NFL Honors.
Yeah.
So that's where they give out the MVP and so many of the different awards throughout that come from this past season, and they want to announce the Hall of Fame there. So what they do is they have all the finalists. The 15 finalists, because they break it down, it starts at like 100 and then it goes 25 and then it goes down to 15 and then they decide from there. So they have all the finalists come to a certain hotel,
right?
And they give you a room and they tell you, okay, about 3:30 in the afternoon. 16:30 in the afternoon here.
Cracky, it depends where you are. Yeah,
oh, I mean, okay. But about 3:30 in the afternoon, they put you in a hotel room, and they say, okay, you just have to stay here.
Yeah.
And sometime over the next 2 to 3 hours, you'll either get a phone call, and the phone call lets you know you didn't get in, or the commissioner of the Hall of Fame will come to your door, knock
so
on your
praying
door.
For the knock, right, not the call.
And,
right?
And let you know that you got in. So this year I was in the hotel for about 2 hours and 20 minutes, and then finally got the knock.
It was room service.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And you're never sure, because I actually got a knock a year ago and it was from somebody else besides the commissioner letting me know I didn't get in. So even though, you're told the knock lets you know you're in, you're still not quite sure.
Yeah.
But then you open the door, and if anybody's ever seen the commissioner of the Hall of Fame,
David Baker,
yes, he's about 6'9",
right,
and weighs about 350. So he's a giant of a
man.
So so when you open that door, and you see this giant of a man. But what a lot of people don't understand is I got my start playing arena football, which is another form of pro football. But but very few guys in the NFL ever played arena football. But when I was playing arena football, David Baker was actually the commissioner of arena football.
Some history together.
We had some history. We had a great relationship. We had been in touch over the years. And so it was a really cool moment for me, because we had gone way back in the start of my professional career, kind of crossed paths with his.
Right.
And so for us now to be face-to-face, and him being the one, because he also inducted me into the Arena Football Hall of Fame. To be the one to let me know that I got into the Pro Football Hall of Fame was pretty special, and a pretty special moment. And my wife and all my kids, my dad, were able to be there in the hotel room with me when I got the knock.
Awesome. And you went from getting that news from a giant of a man to being one of the giants of this game's history. Now, do you kind of think, because obviously you cover the league, you played in the league for all those years, I'm in a special, special group that will be forever.
I think so much about, the path that I traveled to get here. And, you get to this point, and it's hard to fathom yourself in that manner.
Right.
To say, one of the giants of the game, or one of the guys that go down as the greatest, one of the greatest to ever play the game. It's just, it's hard to really think about yourself in that category. But what I do think about is the journey that it took me to get there, and that no one else has ever, or no one else will ever, have the journey and the story that I have. And that to me is probably the coolest thing, is that there's so many kids out there. There's so many adults out there that are trying to find their way and their purpose. And
in all jobs.
Yeah, right, exactly. Not just football. No. And, you know, have people tell them it's time to give up. You know, you're not going to make it. You can't do it. You're not talented enough. You know, that hear all of those things. And for me, I mean, my story was already awesome. And
yes.
I was grateful for it with, you know, three Super Bowl appearances and some MVPs. But to be able to finish on the top of the mountain, I think it kind of finishes the story for a lot of people that may find themselves, you know, in that supermarket, you know, stocking shelves or find themselves, you know, cut or, you know, or let go of a job with somebody saying, you just can't cut it. Now this kind of finishes the story for me, and it allows me to say, hey, you know, I was right there. I was right where you were many a times. But I never stopped believing, and this is where it can all end up.
Yeah.
You can find yourself on the end, the top of the mountain as well. And I think it's going to do a lot to encourage a lot of people, and that's what I'm excited about is that that story will forever be, you know, capitalized in the Hall of Fame, and you know, be a chance to be able to share that with a lot of people, as you said, in a lot of different walks of life.
When it comes to helping other people, do you still help players in the NFL today? Do people reach out to you? Here we are in England now, and I know that Kirk Cousins has been picking your brains, and obviously there's that great respect there for you from the current players. Do you reach out to them? Do they reach out to you sometimes?
It's an ironic thing that over the years I welcome the opportunity to be able to talk with and share with any young guys, whether that be talking about off the field stuff and what it means to be an NFL quarterback or an NFL player and how you handle yourself to, you know, let's talk X's and O's. I love talking X's and O's, so I look forward to that as well. But the amazing thing is very few ever call Neil. I give my number out every year to the young quarterbacks that are entering the league and guys that I meet across the way. And I'm, you know, I watch all the film for the job that I do, you know, covering the league. So I'm always telling guys, hey, if you ever have a question on a play that happened in a game, just give me a call. I got the film there. Or if you ever want to talk. And very few ever reach out. And I've never really been able to put my finger on why that is. Are they intimidated?
Did you reach out when you played to other players? Is it? Do you think it's because they feel like they have the answers?
Well, that's the thing. You wonder if it's they have the answers, you know, because you're never quite sure with this age of player if they think they have all the answers. Or I think some may be afraid to let anybody know that they don't have the answers.
And that they need the
help. And they need help. So it's been an ironic thing that very few have really reached out over the years as much as I look forward to it. Now, with that being said, I have worked with a number of guys, of college guys going to the NFL, and a few NFL guys that have called and have reached out. But it just doesn't happen as much as I would like it to. And I think as much as, you know, these guys, I just keep telling them, if you have somebody that's played, not necessarily me, but if you have access to anybody that's played, always go try to find a different perspective. Try to challenge yourself with somebody who's done it before. So I try to stay involved, and I try to do that as much as I can. But it doesn't happen, and guys don't call as much as I wish they would.
That's surprising. I would have thought they would have been.
I would think the same thing.
And fielding messages left, right,
out,
and
can't figure out why exactly it is.
Yeah, you talk about going out on top, and I mean the way you played right at the end was incredible. I was fortunate to be in Arizona for that overtime game against the Green Bay Packers in the playoffs. One of the most incredible performances I've ever seen, and been fortunate to see. But did that tempt you to want to carry on? And also, again, going back to the phone calls you received, you don't have to name names, but did you receive phone calls to say, hey, Kurt, how about one last go around?
Well, the first thing is that a lot of people always think you make your retirement decision after your last game.
Right.
For me, I did not. I had been contemplating it actually the year before when we went to our last Super Bowl, Super Bowl 43. After I went through that game, I thought, okay, you know, it seemed like a good time. You know, I knew I was getting older. The wear and tear of the game mentally was weighing there. So I considered it there about 2 weeks after the season. I already had the itch again to play. So I'm like, okay, not this year. I'm coming back. But then about halfway through that next season, I was convinced that this was my last season.
Right.
And so not very many people knew. My wife knew, and Larry Fitzgerald, a couple close friends knew. But I knew halfway through that this was it. So no matter how it ended, whether it was good or bad, that was going to be how it finished. So I was very proud of the fact that, you know, as you mentioned, you know, second to last game I ever played in, the last home game I ever played in Arizona, could arguably have been the greatest game that I ever
yeah.
played in and maybe had personally. And so, you know, one thing I always wanted to do is I always wanted to be able to finish my career with people seeing me play at a similar level to how I started my career.
Which doesn't happen with every quarterback.
No,
there's a lot that hang on.
It doesn't happen with very many players at all. So
no.
I was very proud of the fact that, you know, at that point, you know, I'm 39 years old, and, you know, finishing my career like that
yeah.
and being able to play at that level. So that, you know, those weren't determining factors. But it was nice to be able to finish my career the way that I did and kind
yeah.
of go off on my own terms.
Did you get interest from other teams? You don't have to name teams, but
I actually did not.
No.
You know, I think, you know, one of the things that I always represented throughout my career was great character.
And people knew.
And,
so people knew
and,
you.
And I think, yeah, I think when I said I was going to retire,
yeah.
that people knew I was serious.
Yeah.
You know, that I put a lot of thought into it, and it wasn't just a flippant decision. Yeah, I think I'm done. That I had waited out. And so when I said I retired, I actually got absolutely no calls. I even asked my agent that a couple years later. I'm like, did anybody call thinking that maybe I would come out of retirement? And they said, we didn't receive a single call, you know, after I retired. So, you know, one side of that, you go, well, really?
Yeah.
Nobody called?
No.
What, I mean, nobody thought I would play or help them out? But I think the other side
yeah.
of that is just that they knew that it was a decision that I had really thought about. And when I came to that conclusion, it was a definitive conclusion for me.
I think you need to check your phone service card. None of these calls are going through.
What's
right?
up with that?
So you're back here in the UK. It's great to have you back. Obviously, you played one game here at Crystal Palace in 1998. You were with the Amsterdam Admirals. The crowd was modest. Let's put it that way. It was modest. But, you've seen from afar the London games, and now we've got four coming up this year. And last night you got to hear from the British fans as well. What do you make of this now, what we have this kind of groundswell of support for the game here in the UK?
Well, I'm excited about it. I mean, I think when I was here, you know, way back when in NFL Europe, you know, it was a game that was just starting to take off.
Yeah.
And, you know, the one thing you realize about the game of football is that there's so many nuances to it. So it's not a game that you pick up overnight or you just become a diehard fan, because there's so much that goes into
yeah.
it. So that was one thing I understood way back when I played here, was that, you know, we would still get, you know, in Amsterdam, we get about 10,000. You go to the German, you know, teams, and they would get a number of people in the stands. You know, they had the bases there, the military
yep.
bases. So there was a basis for the game. You know, go to London, you'd still get 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people. So you could see their excitement to want to learn the game.
Yep.
You just knew it was going to take some time.
Yeah.
And I think that's been the most impressive thing, you know, being here and hearing people talk and watching the games that come over here to London, you know, and the number of people and the number of jerseys and the fans of different teams
yeah.
is how far it's come. In just the willingness to learn the game,
because
yeah. you can go around the world and you try to introduce our game, and a lot of times there's just intolerance. Like, okay, there's too much to that. We don't want to spend time learning
yeah.
it. We got our own thing. We don't. And what I've been impressed with here is that, you know, they still have their own things. You know, football here,
yeah.
soccer as we call it, right? It's always going to be you know, the pastime here, but that they're open to learning a new game, and they love the nuances of what our game brings, and that's been the exciting part. When you hear questions and they're understanding the relevance of the league, and they're understanding the big issues in the league, and they're asking you questions about this, and you're going, wow, this is stuff that doesn't even affect you yet,
yep.
But you're interested in that. I think that bodes well for the long-term future of the NFL across the country, across the world, but also for the possibility of an NFL team actually one day coming to London.
All right, let's take a couple of quick questions from the mailbag
to wrap up.
Twitter has responded. This one comes from Dave Thomas, who says, does Kurt feel the Cardinals need to draft a quarterback And if so, which one would fit best? Just on the quarterbacks coming out,
yeah.
There's a lot of different opinion about the top guys, isn't there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think every year the college game is so different from the NFL game. And so I think what you're seeing now is it gets harder and harder to evaluate, you know, how good somebody can be, because it doesn't automatically translate, especially at the quarterback position, which is the toughest position. How is that going to translate? What's this guy going to be like, even though he might have been really, really good in college?
Yeah.
How is that going to translate to the NFL? And so that's the question with these quarterbacks is every one of them's got questions. You know, right. There's not one that you go, okay, this is the Andrew Luck of this year where he is going to be able to translate to the next level. A lot of these guys we just don't know. So I don't want to say they're not talented and they can't be franchise quarterbacks. It's just there's a lot of questions there. So with that, I think a lot comes down to the different teams sitting down with these guys and getting into their head and really finding out who they're going to be. With that being said, the Cardinals are definitely looking for a quarterback. Yeah. I know that without a fact. They're looking for the Carson Palmer replacement. Do they feel like it has to happen this year? No, but they feel like it has to happen soon.
Yeah.
And, you know, Carson actually even contemplated retirement this offseason.
Yes.
And so I've heard people close to his camp say that doesn't guarantee this is his last year and he's retiring, but it does let you know that it's getting close and he's contemplating it. And so the Cardinals are aware of that, and they're aware that they don't have – the heir apparent to Carson Palmer on their roster.
There might be there might be a few teams that do that.
Big
Ben flirted
Big
with
Ben,
retirement.
You're talking about Drew Brees, Eli Manning, those guys that, you know, again, maybe not tomorrow they're going to retire, but you know it's coming. And, you know, and that becomes the question is how long can we wait and how confident we are or how confident are we in these quarterbacks in the draft where – we can go ahead and reach for one as the next guy, even though it's a couple years away, because we feel this guy really fits what we do. And so that's going to be, I think, the bigger question is as you get down to these teams, you know, the Cardinals and maybe, you know, even in the second round and you go, okay, is one of these guys really good enough for us to take a chance right now? Or are we looking at maybe a guy next year or somebody else out there that could become a free agent to go after to be the heir apparent? But the Cardinals are looking, and I will not be surprised if they take a quarterback even early in this draft if there's one that they really like and think fits their system.
All right, we'll keep an eye out for that. One last question then. This one comes from Nathan. He says, considering how the Falcons offense played last season, how damaging will the departure of Kyle Shanahan be? And he ends by saying, great arm last night, by the way. I think that's to
was
me.
That in to you?
Well, it came to me. Look, what do you reckon?
Well, I think he saw my arm, even though it didn't hit the bucket.
I think so.
No, I don't know.
What about Kyle Shanahan?
We'll both take it as a compliment.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's the thing is what a lot of people don't understand is, you know, they see the game and they see talent. And the Falcons definitely have talent.
Yeah.
But there's so much that goes into the chemistry of a team. And chemistry oftentimes can be generated by a guy like Kyle Shanahan or a head coach, understanding how to bring all these talented pieces together to make them fit and work at the level that the Falcons did last year. And so that's going to be the real question is, you know, you can very easily get a real talented offense coordinator to come in, but that doesn't mean he sees things like Kyle did. I mean, Kyle did a tremendous job of understanding the uniqueness of each player and being able to place it into their offense so all of their skills could be accentuated, including Matt Ryan. I mean, we never saw Matt Ryan play at the level he did last year until last year.
Right.
And we're all still wondering, okay, did he just, you know, turn a corner? And is this going to be the Matt Ryan we see forever now? Or was that just, you know, magic in a bottle like we saw the year before from Cam Newton?
Right.
And so that's going to be the big question. But a lot goes into being an offense coordinator and doing what Kyle Shanahan did, because they did a lot with their offense. They a lot of moving parts, a lot of differing formations. They change things up a lot. And there's not a lot of guys that have the ability to do that. So I'm really interested to see where Matt Ryan goes, where this Falcons team goes, and where this offense as a whole, what does it look like next year with the departure of such a key piece in Kyle Shanahan.
Just on the, just finishing up there, the Falcons might be an interesting case study in mental toughness, overcoming diversity, because that might be one of the most damaging losses of any game in NFL history. And how Dan Quinn, and whether it's Matt Ryan as one of the faces of this team, how they bounce back, how they fight back, is going to be very interesting to see, because that must have been such a blow.
I think it's going to be as well. And I think the bottom line when you look at things like that is, you know, the uniqueness of sport is that one year doesn't carry over to the other.
Right.
Well, or it doesn't in regards to records and Super Bowls and successes or failures. But that's always the hardest part, is to be able to let last year be last year and to celebrate the great accomplishments they had to get all the way to the Super Bowl, to have shown that they were good enough to win the Super Bowl, even though it fell apart in the end.
Yeah.
Can you celebrate that and then set that aside and now go, but that's over and this is a new season? Or, and I speak from experience, because there was a year when we played the Patriots, the kind of the start of their dynasty in 2001, where we were the favorites.
Strong favorites for that game.
Yes,
right?
And we let that one get away. Mm. We lost on a last-second field goal. And I promise you, we didn't celebrate that success, and we carried that loss with us the next year, basically with the mentality, we missed an opportunity. We're going to make up for that missed opportunity this year.
Yeah.
Instead of just saying, that was last year, this is
Let's move on.
Now we got to, you know, this is a new quest. We took that and said, well, we're gonna prove everybody wrong, you know, based on last year, and we're gonna do it this year. We started the next year 0-6.
Yeah.
You know, trying to be too perfect, to accomplish something from the year before that we didn't get to finish. And I think that's gonna be the true test for the Falcons. Can they compartmentalize that, set it in the past and say, hey, great year, disappointing end, put it in the past and attack the new season differently? Or is that gonna hang with them? And is that going to be the driving force? Because very seldom when you have that kind of baggage can you carry and live up to that expectation the following year. So I'm very interested to see how the Falcons deal with that.
All right. Good stuff, Kurt Warner, Pro Football Hall of Famer. Sounds good, doesn't it? Sounds good.
It's always going to sound good. I don't think it's ever going to ever going to sound bad. It's always going to be a good title, and one that I get to hold. You know, a lot of titles you have to give them away.
Yes,
I get to hold this one forever.
Absolutely. And we look forward to a couple more nights on stage, a few more competitions, but thanks for joining us.
I'm ready. I can't win. I need to win one. I didn't win too many last night, so I'm ready. I'm ready for tonight.
This is it. This is going to be your moment. Cheers, Kurt. Okay, we're continuing to roll on today's Inside the Huddle podcast, and we literally are rolling along the motorway from Liverpool to Nottingham. Joining me now, one of the stars of our NFL UK live trip, Peter King. Peter, thanks for joining me now, and especially thanks on behalf of all the UK fans for joining us on this tour, because I know that the fans are getting a lot out of the insight you're bringing.
It's a revelation, Neil. It really is. Mm. It's been... you know, we're halfway through, and I'm totally taken with how enthusiastic people here are about football. I mean, I've had people say things to me that I'm blown away with, like, you know, you're responsible for me being a big fan and all. I mean, it's just. It really, the internet has done some incredible things, I think, in general, obviously. But one of the things that it has done is that it's made it increasingly possible for somebody who lives in Liverpool to know as much about the New York Giants as somebody who lives in Secaucus.
Right.
It's crazy,
yeah.
But that's exactly the way this world is right now.
And is that how you found it? As you've been questioned on stage by the British fans, you've heard their, well, you've seen their passion for it. We look out from the stage and see a sea of all the different NFL jerseys, but you're hearing from them as well.
Well, I went out the first night in London with a fellow who just wrote an email to me and said, hey, you know, I'll be around if you want to get a beer, let's do it afterwards. So I went out with him and a guy named Neil. He's a school teacher here. Mm-hmm. And then Khaled El Sayed, who works for Pro Football Focus, who lives in London, and he knows more about football than anybody who lives in the United States. And so we discussed how incredibly there's a bunch of savants over here about football who, you know, both who work in the media and who are just fans. And I think a lot of it, Neil, has to do with the fact that, so you bring the game so close to people, and you travel to the U.S. every year,
yeah,
and you basically bring a lot of these people alive. I mean, look, you've seen this. I mean, Kirk Cousins is more colorful and more of a character in England than he is in Washington.
Right.
In part because he doesn't have to have his guard up so much being in England, because everything he says, every word that he says during the season in the Washington area is micro-analyzed.
Yeah.
So he's got to have his guard up. But here, he can just sit around. And, I mean, this is obviously, we're going to talk about a number of things. But one of the most interesting things about this trip, and I told Kirk this, is that he grilled Kurt Warner.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was fascinating on the bus, wasn't it? Just to listen to them.
Listen to Kurt Warner and listen to a quarterback who wants to be great basically interview a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
That was very cool. And I was saying to myself, man, I wish I had my recording equipment.
I would say,
I'm sorry. I want to spy on
this
your conversation.
This is too good. Yeah. Well, Peter, people always say to me, they say, what do you love about the fan tours that you do and the tours with players? And I say, of course I love the stuff on stage, because it is great. They let their guard down. They show what great ambassadors they are for the NFL. But for me, some of it just sitting and eavesdropping on the bus to some of these legends. And we've had big names over in the past. And
I tell you somebody who you need to get?
Well, I've already been briefed by the head of NFL UK that at some point I have to sit with you and pick your brains about future guests. So
okay,
give me one right now.
But I'm going to just tell you, and you're going to say, oh, my God, don't tell me that guy. I'm going to tell you who you need to get over here. And who would do it? It's Josh McCown. And
oh, okay.
you would say, ah, well, Josh McCown, he's in the twilight. He's 38 years old. Josh McCown is one of the smartest football players I've ever talked to. And he's got a rare gift for sharing the game and telling you stories. And he's played on about 900 teams.
Right, right.
And so he's been with everybody. And so all I'm saying is that people might hear, well, we got Josh McCown. Well, I'm going to get him on my podcast. He's going to talk for 45 minutes, and people will be screaming for more.
Right.
And
yeah,
the one other guy who you should get, and again, not one other guy. I mean, we could talk about 20 guys. I really think somebody who would love this, and it's not at a great time of year for him, but somebody who would really love this and who would be great is Mike Mayock.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Mike Mayock not only would have great opinions on players, you know, here's a guy who's played in the league, who's close to Bill Belichick, who really has the trust in the ear of everybody in the NFL, who knows the game so well. He could sit and talk. I mean, if you got Kurt Warner and Mike Mayock together, you'd have to have a 15-hour program because neither of them would want to leave.
Wouldn't want to stop. Yeah. But the good thing is we do these year-round, so we can make it work for their schedules. And somebody like Josh McCown actually would give you the reality of life in the NFL.
Yes,
because it's
would.
Not all roses and flowers and Super Bowl confetti.
I'm only worried about, like, when I look at what you do. Okay, like, can you imagine if you're a Washington fan and you live somewhere in northwest England, and you say, oh, my God, my quarterback is going to be here.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to go.
That's
not ifs, ands, or buts. You have to go. And so, and I only worry about people saying, Josh McCown. But believe me, if you're listening to this podcast and you hear that Josh McCown is going to be in a small theater near you, go. Listen.
There we go. One of the questions you've been asked, one of the questions that's come up time and time again on these tours is the potential of a London franchise. I know you've answered it extensively the last couple of nights, but for the purposes of this podcast, you do feel that's going to happen at some point, right?
I think it's inevitable. because you've got so many owners in the league, influential owners, people like Jerry Jones, Robert Kraft, Jeffrey Lurie is very bullish on international play. You have people who basically want it to happen. And, Neil, the one thing we've learned in the last 16 months, this is an owner's league.
Yes.
And I don't mean to diminish the importance of players. And I mean, it's silly because nobody comes to a stadium on Sunday to see Jeffrey Lurie own a team. You know, they come to see Carson Wentz play football. But what happens now is that, and I think the most important thing right now is that people see that London is ready.
Yeah.
And as much as the logistics are going to be an absolute nightmare, because they will be, and one of the things I asked Kirk Cousins on my podcast is I said to him, you know, I remember a guy named Corey Simon. He was a defensive lineman for the Eagles, played some for the Colts, and I will never forget Corey Simon was going to be a free agent, and I had some contact with him. I don't specifically remember whether I was interviewing him about where he was going to go or anything, but I remember mentioning Seattle to him, and he goes, "Oh, I mean, Seattle's way too far. I would never go to Seattle." So I really wonder, and Cousins made the point, maybe there will have to be some accommodation made for a London franchise. And I have always felt that a London franchise should either have some, they should have some financial incentive for players to go there.
Yeah.
Maybe that if you go play for the franchise in London, you would get, say, a 15% bump on your salary, and or some family allowance or something. There would have to be something, because I think where a team in London would be hurt, Neil, in my opinion, is in free agency.
Right.
Whereas I think it would be a really cool opportunity to go live in England for 3 years.
Not everyone's going to think that, right?
Not every, and believe me, because you've got all these players from Texas and California and Florida and everything. They don't, what, how can their family come and see him play if they're playing half the year in London?
Yeah.
So, but anyway, I think the NFL will figure out a way to do it. And I think, I don't know, 5-6 years, I think 2022, 23, something like that, I think there will be a team in London.
But Peter, it shows that that's where we've kind of moved the game on, because for a number of years it was just a conversation. Can they play one game? Can they play two games in London? Do you think one day there will ever be a franchise? Now the NFL UK are talking to the government in the UK. They're talking about, how do we deal with taxation of players? Do we base a team on the East Coast of America for tryouts? They're actually now starting to dig down into the to
logistics.
Which means that they are looking seriously at this.
Well, I mean, you know, there's a bunch of issues to raise, and one is, you know, I would agree with you. I think there needs to be a base for this team, let's say in around East Rutherford, New Jersey, let's just say, for the sake of argument, somewhere around New York. I think what you need is, you need to be in a major hub. You need to be in a place where, let's say you have your director of player personnel would live in New Jersey. You would have a couple of pro scouts in the U.S. And if you're going to try out players on a Monday, you have the ability for your coach and general manager in London to be able to watch those workouts live if they choose. So, I mean, I think the technology is there for it to work. I think the one thing that you hear about, I remember one time when I was writing about the Dallas Cowboys, and when Jimmy Johnson's day, they had 13 players in for a workout on Tuesday.
Right.
And they were going to sign, I don't know, one, two, three of them. And so there is where the challenge would come in, because after you work a player out, then he's got to fly for 6 hours and be ready to practice the next day in a foreign country. It's a little weird. I mean, you'd have to tell every one of these free agents, oh, by the way, don't come to this tryout, don't come to this workout unless you have your passport. You know, so it just, there's all these problems that are all these issues that nobody's ever thought of before, and now people are going to have to think about.
Peter, let's broaden the discussion out to your job, which is many people's dream job. And sometimes when people ask me about covering the NFL, I tell them, well, it's just this tremendous year-round soap opera. Do you, in all the years you've covered it, find it to be that?
I find it that every year around July 25th, at the start of training camp, I feel like I put my hands on the steering wheel of a car that's going 25 miles an hour too fast. And I just say, hold on until February 9th. And the car just goes. Yeah. The car is... it's one of those self-driving models
right.
that I have nothing to do with.
But it doesn't even stop in the off-season, this car.
No, but, well, I make it stop in the off-season some
right.
because, in my opinion, one of the things the NFL has done to the bane of my existence is they've sort of stretched out the events in the off-season
yes.
to all be these mega events. You know, basically 3 weeks after the Super Bowl, you get right into the scouting combine. You know, maybe a week or two later after the combine is over, you get into free agency. That lasts for about 3 weeks heavily.
Yeah.
Then in April and really for half of March, you're doing draft preparation. And just very, very briefly, sanity returns in June and July.
Yes.
And then you start it all over again. But I always, a guy for the NFL named Joe Brown, who was a longtime
yes.
vice president
uh-huh.
of PR, retired last fall. And I really wanted to tell the story because I think Joe Brown is the guy more than anybody else who's responsible for making the NFL a year-round venture
mm.
because he was jealous in the off-season. This is a long time ago, maybe the 70s. He was jealous of all the attention baseball received in
okay.
the off-season. You know, they would have general managers meetings and all the writers would go. There'd be all these trade rumors and everything. And he would say, man, we need one of those. So I should blame Joe Brown for taking too many antacids in the month of April. But anyway, but the NFL really has figured out a way, you know, in a lot of ways, they've basically figured out a way to make April a really interesting month on the football calendar.
Obviously, media has changed in the more than 30 years since you've been covering pro football, but what about the interactions with players and coaches? Are they vastly different now? Has that changed? Because obviously, things like the internet and Twitter and all of those kind of things have changed in terms of your output, but what about the interactions on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis?
It's basically changed because so many people have force fields up in front of them,
right.
and they don't want to be very honest. They don't want to be forthcoming. And I tell, at the MMQB, the website I run, I tell people all the time, I said, in a lot of ways, I feel sorry for you. I came up, in my opinion, in the golden age of covering the NFL.
Mm.
In 1984, the first year I covered the NFL, I lived in a dorm at training camp with the Bengals. Boomer Esiason used to, there were two phones in this giant dorm, two pay phones.
Right.
And I had a phone installed in my room. Boomer Esiason used to come by every night and call his girlfriend. So therefore, I got to know Boomer.
Yeah.
And Chris Collinsworth was on that team.
Right.
Anthony Munoz, the coach, Sam Weich, rookie coach. He said, hey, anytime you ever need me, my meetings end at about 9:45 at night, come and knock on my door. He was 15 doors down the hall from me on the first floor of this dormitory. 10 times in a 5-week period, I went and knocked on his
right.
door. And we just sat there and we talked football. Paul Brown lived down the hall. It just.
Yeah.
So first of all, I was fortunate because I was birthed into almost with Paul Brown owning the team, watching practice every day, asking him questions. I realize now that was football royalty.
Right.
You don't really realize it at the time. But I think most people right now who start to cover the game, they say, man, this is hard. The restrictions, the media periods are so scheduled, so programmed. There's no spontaneity.
Right.
And so I was really lucky to grow up in a time where you really had a chance to get to know players and have interactions with them, where they weren't worried that if one comma in a quote was wrong, they were going to get smashed on Twitter.
So what breaks down those barriers? Is it time and being able to have time with people? Because I saw Jarvis Landry opening up to you on the bus last night for a great piece that's on the MMQB right now. I saw yourself and Kirk Cousins chatting, and I've been in a fortunate situation because I think I do different things with the players because that kind of helps you stand out. As Odell Beckham's jogging off the field at the Pro Bowl, he runs and comes and finds me and does an interview, and so I think sometimes having time with people and building relationships
helps. And I think there's a couple of things there because, look, I tell the story all the time that at the 2000 NFL Scouting Combine, there are somewhere between 15 and 20 members of the media there.
Right.
This year, 16 years later, 17 years later, there are 1,341 reporters there. So you tell me what that means. Yeah. I'll tell you what it means. People who you used to sidle up to in the lobby of the Crown Plaza Hotel in Indianapolis and ask them, hey, what do you think of this Plexico Burris as a prospect? How do you think he'll be? Well, now the only availability you have with most of those guys is in a formal press conference. Otherwise, they hide.
Right.
And they go, they use the back way and all that. So...
Because they don't want to reach out to thousands of people instead of...
Well, here's what they don't want. They don't want you, they don't want to see you. Maybe they would be happy to talk to you, let's say.
Yeah.
But if they see you and if they're talking to you, all of a sudden they're going to get swarmed.
Right, right.
Because there's reporters everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's... And look, I don't... I am not one of these get-off-my-lawn guys who says, oh, it was better way back then. Oh, it's terrible now. It's the old Bill Belichick thing. It is what it is. Whatever it is, that's how you have
how
to
you
exist.
Adapt, right? Yeah.
So you have to adapt or, you know, go cry to your mother. But my whole thing, I believe now, is that that's why relationships are more important than ever. And honestly, you know, getting to know Kirk Cousins a little bit on this trip makes the trip, honestly, makes it all worthwhile to me.
Let's take a couple of questions on Twitter, Peter. This one comes from Martin Allmark, who says, if you were commissioner for 5 minutes, what rule change or league change would you make? He says, I should have asked this question last night, but I've only just thought of it now. It's a good one.
I'll give you one rule change, and then I'll give you one thing that if I were the league, I'd do differently. My rule change would be that I would make defensive pass interference not a spot foul.
It would be
a 10-yard penalty from the line of scrimmage. That's
it. You're giving up too much if it's a 50-yard penalty.
Look,
downfield.
I go to training camps and I see teams practice, let's throw the ball deep and hope for interference.
Yeah.
And last year, I think this was 2015, I think there were 54 penalties of 20 yards or more on downfield throws on defensive pass interference. That's too unfair.
Yep.
Okay, in my opinion. The second thing I would do is I think I would stand in front of my ownership group and I would say, listen, we're not going to be about stadiums over fans. We're going to put a team back in San Diego. We're going to put a team back in Oakland. Even if we have to play in those dumps, we are going to play football there because those fans deserve the game. They love the game, and they're passionate about it. And, I mean, so, Neil, I'm a baseball fan, and I think many of your listeners will probably know who the Boston Red Sox are.
Yeah.
They're a famous old baseball team in the U.S. They're the Liverpool of America. They play in an Anfield-type stadium, Fenway Park. a little bandbox, a little tiny little stadium. If baseball were the NFL, they would have outlawed Fenway Park, and they would have told the owners of the Red Sox, you need to build a shiny new bauble-filled stadium. Mm. And we wouldn't be able to go to Fenway Park anymore to what John Updike once called a lyric little bandbox. And we'd go to yet another cookie-cutter new stadium. And look, I love baseball stadiums. They're, so many of them are modern and cool and fun.
Yeah.
But let's be honest, there's some charm about going to Wrigley Field in Chicago and about going to Fenway Park. I'd go to Wrigley Field in Chicago to watch the opera. And, I mean, never mind baseball. And I just think we're focused way, way, way too much on increasing the revenue. Or not we, they are focused way, way too much on increasing the revenue in football and not necessarily being as concerned about the people who are going to scream their guts out on Sunday for their team.
Well, I'll give you a little bit of feedback from the UK fans, because I see it a lot, the way they look at this and how they have questions about it, is that they, first of all, the moving of franchises is pretty alien to British sports fans. It doesn't really happen that much here. So that kind of, I think, is why you got quite a few questions on that on the tour about the number of teams that have moved from the NFL in the last 13, 14 months. And the other thing, I think the question that comes up to me a lot of the times is, but these billionaires are asking somebody else to pay for it as well. So it's, you know, that doesn't always kind of
that was one of my problems really with Mark Davis and what he did in Oakland. I mean, you know, if you own a franchise and you have, and I understand, I know why Mark Davis didn't want to take a partner on, but if you can't afford to do what you're doing yourself, it's the way I look at it, take a partner on, you know, and
make it work where you are.
And stay where you are. It would be one thing, and it would be one thing if your community was not supporting your team. If it's a 60,000-seat stadium and you're drawing 25,000 people, and you try and try and try and you can't get it done, you can't. But that wasn't the case in San Diego. The Chargers lose all the time, and people are still coming to the games. It's the same thing in Oakland. To not have the black hole anymore is just, I think it's absurd. I think it's terrible for football. Mm. And so look, Roger Goodell said a long time ago, this is going to be a $25 billion with a B entity by such and such a year. I forget what year he said, but this is going to be a $25 billion entity. Well, you know, I understand why you want to be an incredibly profitable organization. Mm. I get that. Owners want to make money, obviously. Sure. But, you know, you can't sacrifice the soul of the game.
This is a good question from Richard Wyatt. I actually had a similar question earlier for Kurt Warner. He said, Peter spoke with Dan Quinn recently. Does he believe the Falcons will avoid a Super Bowl hangover? I spoke to Kurt about this earlier, Peter. This is going to be a fascinating case study in overcoming adversity, because that might have been the most damaging loss to a team in NFL history, certainly one of them, to lose a Super Bowl in that fashion. Dan Quinn hasn't hidden from the fact that it was painful.
He answered the questions over and over and over again. He was on my podcast a couple of weeks ago, and one of the things that impressed me, I thought one of the most interesting little factoids out of that podcast, is that he had watched the game about 10 times and sort of examined, okay, here's what we did wrong. He wanted to watch the performance of every player in that game. And I think he understands now, A, they really got worn down defensively. They played 99 snaps. But I think also one of the things he realized, a friend of his in the coaching business said, you should try to watch this from the Patriots' perspective. Mm. And you should try to look at what the Patriots did, you know, basically from the third quarter on. And I think one of the things that he saw, that he drew value from, is that there was never a sense of desperation on New England's part in that game. And I think that tells you a big lesson. When I talked to Tom Brady a week after the season, one of the things he told me is that, look, one of the reasons that we're not really nervous down 28-3, it's pretty simple. If you have, and I forget, I'm paraphrasing him, but if you have, say, 23 minutes left in the game, which is what they had when they got the ball down 28-3.
Yeah.
If you have that much time left in the game and you're down 25 points, okay, so you are in a four-score game at that point. You need to have the ball four more times. He said, well, we're probably going to have the ball five times in the last 25 minutes of a game. So if you're going to have the ball five times, he said, it wasn't like we weren't moving the ball on them.
Right.
We were moving. We were just, you know, not making plays or whatever. But anyway, the whole point I was making is that Dan Quinn started to look at this from the Falcons, from the Patriots' point of view, and learned a lot. One of the things he learned, I believe, is, hey, you know, look at the team on the other side. They're just playing football. They're not doing anything really differently. They're not playing with a desperation. The quarterback is not all pissy out there.
Right.
You know, they're just playing the game that they're very good at playing. And that's how they caught up, and that's how eventually they passed him.
Just finishing up on Inside the Huddle with Peter King. Peter, you mentioned Tom Brady there. Quite the coup to get the one-on-one with him at his holiday home, right? I mean, in an undisclosed location that cannot be disclosed for obvious reasons. But that must have been quite special, because you talk about access and you talk about how it's all in a kind of staged press conference setting. And then here you are, just a matter of days after one of the greatest performances in Super Bowl history, although Tom Brady didn't think he had that good a game, did he, reading what you wrote? But how did that come about, and what was that experience like, actually being not in a press conference but in his home like that?
I think, how it came about is, a couple of years ago, after the Patriots beat Seattle, I asked Brady after the game, I said, hey, when the dust settles later in this week, would you mind if we sort of dissected these last two drives? You know, maybe we could speak on the phone Friday or Saturday.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, let's let things settle down a little bit. So I talked to him, and I wrote a story that basically had Brady talking about driving the ball for two touchdown drives in the last 10 minutes of the game to beat the number one ranked defense in football. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's probably the two drives he'll remember most in his life. And so this time, after this game, first of all, I never saw Tom Brady after the game.
Oh, okay.
I never laid eyes on Brady after the game.
Huh.
I was looking for him, but, you know, it's pretty much chaos
down there.
And I guess I just missed him the whole time. So I finished writing my column on Monday, and I asked him, I said, now this is going to be probably level jumping a little bit, but I wonder if you would consider seeing me and having me interview you in person for a couple of reasons. And I open up the possibility of, you know, what I want to do is I want to record this for posterity.
Yeah.
Because in my opinion, you know, this is going to go down as the greatest game of your life. And I really want you to be able to have a permanent record of it. And really, I want you to relive what happened very soon after the game, so that one day, if one of your children might say, Dad, what happened in the second half against that Falcons in the Super Bowl? You can just put this on. This will be your crystal clearest memory of that day. And so he wrote me back in a couple of days. He said, I'll do it. And I'll give you your choice. We could either do it in Boston on Friday. This is 5 days after the Super Bowl.
Yep.
Or we can do it in Montana on Sunday, which is 7 days after the Super Bowl. And what would you choose? But anyway, so I went out to Montana, and it was just fascinating. It was an absolute sparkling, beautiful, crystal clear Sunday afternoon. For those in the UK, it was 1 degree. For those in the United States, it was about 35 degrees
Fahrenheit.
And It was cold, but it was just pristinely beautiful. And so I sat there with him in a cabin, and to call this a cabin would be like if somebody would say, hey, so you know, the Four Seasons hotels, I think they have Four Seasons in Europe.
Yep.
So you go to a Four Seasons hotel and imagine taking four presidential suites and putting a rustic log.
So there are cabins and cabins.
This is, to call this a cabin is probably not so correct. But anyway, so it was utterly beautiful.
Yeah.
And right outside the picture window where I interviewed him in the middle of this cabin is one of the most beautiful mountains you've ever seen. It felt like we were in the Alps.
Wow.
But anyway, so it was great. But what made it truly great is that Tom Brady, in my opinion, I've never heard him give an interview that was any better.
Yeah.
And I think that he wanted to do it.
Yeah.
That helps. He wanted to get it down
to get
on
it all
record.
Out. Yeah.
Exactly what he tried to do that day.
Yeah.
Exactly. And because after the game, I had spent some time with Josh McDaniels, you know, in the bowels of the stadium in Houston, and he went through play by play of a lot of those drives. So I had some institutional knowledge of why some things happen, and I'm able to ask him questions. So he was totally into it, and, you know, it's cool. I now have a CD copy of that interview.
Yeah.
And when I see him in the spring at either the mini camp or training camp, I'm going to hand it to him and say, here's my part of the bargain.
There we go.
You know, this on for one of your kids one day. But and just the last thing I would say about it is that, look, I have become a huge podcast fan.
Yeah.
And I listen to a lot of them.
Yep.
When I work out, there's a couple of them that I listen to. Like, there's a podcast called This American Life on National Public Radio in the U.S. that I really love.
Yep.
There's The Moth. There's a podcast called The Moth, which is a storytelling podcast.
Right.
It's just people telling stories. It's fabulous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But anyway, so I've really kind of gotten into the genre a little bit.
Yeah.
And I was so happy that above the story itself, which was tremendous, and I was very fortunate to have been a part of this, but as much as this, I was able to have Tom Brady for 76 minutes record his voice and give that to people who
fantastic.
Could just download it for free.
It's amazing.
What a world. What a world this is. So now if you want to hear Tom Brady for 76 minutes, not just talk about the Super Bowl, but to talk about his philosophy about training and so many thoughts about life and about revenge that he just never felt with Roger Goodell and all this kind of stuff. If you want to hear that, all you have to do is, you know, go online and Google in Peter King podcast, Tom Brady. You can download it, and in 30 seconds you could be listening to what I think is Tom Brady at his frank best that he's ever been. It's just, the world is so fun right now. Yeah. You know, to be able to do something like that. Anyway,
it is a great listen. I listen to your podcast. I think it's fantastic. I like listening to podcasts. I listen to Mike Florio. He can be a little bit get off my lawn, but I like it anyway.
I love Florio.
He's salty. I like
it. He's very opinionated, and he believes. You know what I like about Mike? So I work with him at NBC, and once, you know, we were talking about things, and I was trying to defend another writer,
right?
And he said, "Peter, you know what? I don't want to be in your little boys' club. I don't want to be a part of that.
He doesn't care, does he?
I don't want to be." Hey, Neil, what stadium is this?
Stoke City.
This is Stoke City.
We've gone past. We've been past Anfield, Goodison Park.
Yeah,
and now Everton. There we are. That's Everton, and so there's Stoke City.
How are they doing this year?
Middleish, mid-table,
And what's so how far are we now from Nottingham?
I think about an hour. We're about halfway.
We're halfway there.
We are done here. Just one last question on Tom Brady.
Ahead.
And you, I've interviewed him a couple of times, but I don't know him like you know him with that time. He seems to hit reset, him and Belichick, and it reflects on that entire team. They hit reset so quickly, and they'll be as hungry as ever come the opening day of training.
Here's the best way to describe that is, so I had Chris Sims on my podcast. Chris Sims is Phil's son.
Yep.
He played college football at Texas. He was drafted by the Bucks, played a little bit until suffering a spleen injury with the Bucks, and now does a bunch of media stuff in New York. So I had him on my podcast in the fall. We were talking about Belichick, and I think this would apply to Brady too. And he made this point that he goes, basically that, hey, he could be in a meeting on May 11th about some mundane thing, and it's exactly the same thing as he'll be in a meeting before a playoff game in January.
Yeah.
He just, in other words, he's got the whole thing all figured out. You know how people say you don't want to get too high, you don't want to get too low?
Right.
You know, Bill Belichick lives that because that's just, he's done this for so long. Nothing is a surprise. Nothing is really different. It is simply the aspect of his life where he says, essentially, he says, hey, I'm going to do this job, and this is how I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
If I win, I win. If I don't, I'm going to learn from it, but I'm going to come back tomorrow, and I'll be ready to go again. And so it isn't these tremendous, you know, peaks and valleys. It's just always the same. He's a flatline guy. And I think Brady, even though Brady is emotional, Brady is deep down a flatline guy because he knows that he's got to live to fight another day tomorrow.
All right, Peter, it's been fantastic chatting to you on the Inside the Huddle podcast. Really enjoying spending time with you on the tour. Thanks for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you, Neil.